Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think we ought to conceive of our gun problem as a problem of gun capitalism, as one related to the fundamental legitimacy we've granted to gun capitalism as a democracy. And that's what sets us apart from almost every other country in the world.
It's been another deadly week in the United States as gun violence shatters families and communities across the country. We'll speak with Andrew McKevin, author of the forthcoming book, Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture and Control in Cold War America. Then to South Texas, where Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship blew up 4 minutes after launch Thursday. We'll speak to a community organizer on the ground, long opposed to the work SpaceX in Texas.
We've seen photos of, you know, particulates falling on people, people's windows shattering. You know, what Elon Musk characterizes as a successful launch, just means another dangerous explosion in our community.
And we'll speak to a leading human rights activist in Yemen, where at least 79 people died this week in a stampede at a charity giveaway in the latest disaster to hit Yemen, which has been devastated by the U.S.-backed Saudi war.
Throughout the course of the war, there has been a lot of horrific human rights violations in Yemen. All of these violations were left without accountability and justice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two warring factions of Sudan's military have announced a 72-hour ceasefire coinciding with the start of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. Despite the announcement, residents of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, and neighboring cities report gunfire and shelling have continued. The World Health Organization reports at least 413 people have been killed and more than 3,500 others injured in the week since fighting erupted between Sudan's army and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group. Earlier today, Sudan's top general and de facto ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, made his first public remarks since the fighting broke out.
There remains hope that we are with our great people, and we will overcome this tribulation and emerge from it unified, strong, and coherent. And our slogan will only get stronger. One army, one people.
In his speech, the general claimed Sudan's military is committed to a transition to civilian rule, even though he led the coup 18 months ago that toppled Sudan's civilian Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. CNN is reporting the Russian mercenary Wagner Group has been supplying Sudan's rapid support forces with missiles that could not be independently confirmed. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's been rotating more troops into its base in Djibouti to prepare for the possible evacuation of U.S. diplomatic personnel from Sudan, they say. A new study finds the vast ice sheets covering Greenland and Antarctica are melting three times faster than they were just 30 years ago. Study co-author Ruth Mottram described the findings as disastrous, warning coastal communities will face increasing amounts of flooding as sea level rise accelerates due to the melting ice. On Thursday, the European Commission's climate agency reported last year was the continent's second warmest year on record and warned this year is on track to set more record temperatures across Europe and around the world. This is Samantha Burgess of the Copernicus Climate Change Service.
We saw prolonged and extensive heat waves and also prolonged and extensive drought over much of the continent. We had the highest emissions of carbon from wildfires in a number of countries, and those wildfires were bigger than average. They started earlier than average, and the season persisted longer than average. We also saw record ice melt from glaciers in the European Alps. So climate change isn't a future problem. It is a current problem.
NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made a surprise visit to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, Thursday for talks with President Volodymyr Zelensky. During a joint press conference, Zelensky said it's time for NATO to invite Ukraine to join the military alliance. Stoltenberg replied the issue would be discussed at the NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, in July.
This will be high on the agenda of the meeting and also in the lead-up and the preparations for the Vilnius summit. Ukraine's future is in the Euro-Atlantic family. Ukraine's future is in NATO. All allies agree on that.
This week, Ukraine received U.S.-made surface-to-air Patriot missile systems for the first time. Meanwhile, Russian officials have admitted a Russian warplane bombed the city of Belgorod near Ukraine late Thursday after it accidentally fired a weapon. Russia's defense ministry said some buildings have been damaged, but no one was injured in the blast, which left a huge crater in the street near several apartment buildings. President Biden's pick to lead the Labor Department testified before a Senate panel Thursday as her nomination hearings got underway. Julie Hsu appears to face roadblocks by both Republicans and conservative Democrats who oppose her pro-worker, pro-union track record. Hsu, who's serving as deputy labor secretary and is also a civil rights attorney, would be the first Asian American to serve as secretary in Biden's cabinet.
After law school, I spent nearly two decades representing workers. What I learned is that too many people still work full-time, year-round, and live in poverty. Too many are denied a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. At the same time, I learned that working people, when given a chance to organize, to be heard, not only make things better for themselves, but help to bring the American dream within reach to those around them.
In Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has refused to sign into law a draconian anti-LGBTQ bill, which allows for the death penalty in some cases and criminalizes even identifying as gay. Instead, the president urged the Ugandan parliament to make the legislation even harsher. He made the announcement Thursday as he praised lawmakers for their efforts and rejected international pressure to undo the controversial measure. The intensifying violence against the LGBTQ community has forced many to flee. This is a Ugandan photographer and LGBTQ activist speaking from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Queer people can't get medication. Queer people can't get education. And at the moment, there is a lot of mob justice that is happening, beating people up, killing people. Suicide rates are also rising because, again, within the crisis of this, it's traumatic. You know, many people can't really handle that. So before the government kills you, people are killing themselves.
To see our interview with Ugandan LGBTQ activist Frank Mugisha, go to our website, democracynow.org. Back in the United States, the Republican-controlled House has passed a bill that would ban transgender women and girls from competing in sports at schools and colleges that receive federal funding. The measure has no chance of passing the Democratic-led Senate, while the White House said President Biden would veto the bill if it made it to his desk. Bans on transgender athletes are being challenged by the ACLU in Idaho, Tennessee, and West Virginia. This week, North Dakota became the latest state to enact a law criminalizing gender-affirming care for minors. Over 450 bills attacking the rights of transgender people have been introduced in state legislatures nationwide. In Atlanta, Georgia, protesters rallied outside the Fulton County Jail on Thursday, demanding the closure of the 11-story, 1,300-bed facility, demanding justice for LaShawn Thompson, the 35-year-old black man who was being held in the jail's psychiatric wing, was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs in his cell last year. This according to Thompson's family. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump reports former NFL quarterback and activist Colin Kaepernick has agreed to pay for an independent autopsy of Thompson's body. Meanwhile, Fulton County commissioners have approved $5 million in funding for emergency improvements to the jail. Thompson's family and local activists are calling on the Department of Justice to launch an investigation. Tiffany Roberts of the Southern Center for Human Rights said, quote, "How long will we hide from the reality that Fulton County is chronically dysfunctional dysfunctional, and there is no humanity in a system like this, she asked. To see our Democracy Now! Broadcast exclusive interview with the family attorney, as well as LaShawn Thompson's brother and sister, go to democracynow.org. Oklahoma's Court of Criminal Appeals has denied the latest request by death row prisoner Richard Glossop for a new trial, paving the way for his execution May 18th. Thursday's ruling came after Oklahoma's attorney general asked for Glossop's 1998 murder conviction to be vacated in a decades-long case in which Glossop narrowly escaped execution three times. Glossop has always maintained his innocence. Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow and staunch Trump ally, was ordered to pay $5 million for losing his 2021 Prove Mike Wrong challenge after a computer forensics expert showed that there was no Chinese interference in the 2020 election, as Lindell had claimed. An arbitration panel found Robert Zeidman, a Republican who twice voted for Trump, disprove Mike Lindell's data, which he called manufactured and bogus. SpaceX is claiming success after the first launch of its massive new rocket dubbed Starship. The two-stage prototype lifted off Thursday morning from SpaceX's sprawling base on Texas' Gulf Coast near the U.S. border with Mexico, becoming the largest and heaviest machine ever to fly under its own power. At least six of the rocket's 33 engines failed during flight, and the vehicle self-destructed over the Gulf of Mexico about 4 minutes after liftoff. Residents of Port Isabel near the launch site reported particulates rain down on their neighborhoods. The fiery end to the launch was the latest in a series of explosions around SpaceX launch site near the Lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge. After headlines, we'll go to Brownsville, Texas, for the latest. BuzzFeed News is shutting down. The announcement was made by BuzzFeed CEO and co-founder Jonah Peretti in an email to staff, where he said the company is laying off 15% of its employees across multiple divisions. HuffPost, which BuzzFeed acquired in 2020, will now be the company's sole news brand. This came on the same day the digital news media company Insider, formerly known as Business Insider, said it would cut 10% of its workforce. And in Chile, President Gabriel Boric announced he is moving to nationalize his country's lithium industry.
Chile has one of the largest lithium reserves of the world. It is a mineral that, being in bus and electric cars, energy storage, batteries, is key in the fight against the climate crisis and in the fight against climate change. This is an opportunity for economic growth that will be difficult to beat in the short term.
Any private companies extracting lithium will have to partner with the state, which will hold majority stakes in new production contracts. This comes as environmental activists this week protested Chile's approval to extend Anglo American's copper mining activities in the Andes, which advocates say threatens a nearby glacier and the area's water supply. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It has been another deadly week in the United States as gun violence shattered families and communities across the country. In one of the most shocking cases, a white homeowner in Kansas City shot a black teenager in the head who rang his doorbell by mistake. Prosecutors say 84-year-old Andrew Lester exchanged no words with 16-year-old Ralph Yarl before opening fire on him through a glass door, striking him in the chest and head. Yarl had simply gone to the wrong house to pick up his younger twin brothers. Yarl survived. He's now recovering from a traumatic brain injury. The shooter's grandson appeared on CNN Thursday and described his grandfather as a racist who avidly watched Fox News and embraced conspiracy theories. Meanwhile, in New York, a 65-year-old man has been charged with second-degree murder for fatally shooting a 20-year-old woman named Kaylin Gillis, who'd mistakenly pulled into the wrong driveway. In Elgin, Texas, two cheerleaders were shot by a man in a parking lot of a grocery store on Tuesday after one of them mistakenly tried to get into his car, thinking it was her own. Meanwhile, a North Carolina man has turned himself in after shooting a six-year-old and her parents after the girl tried to retrieve a basketball that had rolled into the man's yard. The number of mass shootings in the United States this year has now reached 166. On average, there's been more than one mass shooting every day this year in the United States. In Alabama, six people have been arrested on murder charges in connection with the recent mass shooting at a Sweet 16 birthday party in Dadeville, Alabama, that left four people dead and 32 injured. Over the weekend, the National Rifle Association held its annual convention in Indianapolis, Indiana, less than 2 hours from Louisville, Kentucky, where a gunman armed with an AR-15-style semi-automatic assault rifle killed five people at a bank where he used to work April 10th. To talk more about the gun epidemic in the United States, we're joined now by Andrew McKevitt, Associate Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University, author of the forthcoming book, Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture and Control in Cold War America. Drew, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, though under horrible circumstances. Why don't we start off where I just left off? And that is, as you have one mass shooting after another, right, Louisville followed Nashville, where six people were killed, three of them 9-year-olds and three adults. The NRA holds its meeting. Republican presidential wannabes flock to that meeting. It is less than 2 hours from Louisville, where a mass shooting had just taken place. Can you put this all in context for us?
Sure, Amy. Well, thanks so much for having me. And I do wish this were not the kind of conversation we were having, but it does seem inevitable and perennial at this point. I think to put this in some context, I think we talk about our gun problem all wrong. I think the way we talk about it and the precise language we use to talk about these problems is the kind of language that the NRA and the gun lobby wants us to use. We often think about our gun problem in the language of rights and the law and the Second Amendment. We adopt the language of good guys with guns and bad guys with guns and the so-called law-abiding citizen. And when we do that, we're using the very same language that they've crafted to understand these crises that we're seeing more and more. Instead, as I said at the beginning there, I think we ought to conceive of our gun problem as a problem of gun capitalism. That is, as a material problem. We are rapidly approaching the point at which we will be a country of a half billion guns. That will happen before the end of this decade. And I don't think it's possible to conceive of solutions to our gun problems without that larger, without recognizing that larger materiality of guns in which we live, in which we are effectively swimming.
So you're talking about more guns than people in the United States. I want to go to this issue of the NRA just a day after the five people were killed in a mass shooting in neighboring Kentucky. Indiana Senate Republicans honored NRA Chief Wayne LaPierre, ahead of the NRA's annual convention in Indianapolis. Moms Demand Action responded in a report by WTHR 13.
They have the audacity to stand on the floor of our Senate in our state house and honor the organization that far and away is most responsible for the proliferation of guns in our country. It's really a painful reminder that the Republican Party of the state of Indiana doesn't care.
13 News asked LaPierre directly about the criticism.
We think all these federal gun laws ought to be enforced and we could dramatically reduce crime in America.
That last voice, Wayne LaPierre. Well, at the NRA convention, Donald Trump gave the keynote address and called for firearms training for teachers.
I will also create a new tax credit to reimburse any teacher for the full cost of a concealed carry firearm and training from highly qualified experts. Who's better? Who's better? If even 5% of teachers, people that are skilled with arms, we want that. 5% were voluntarily armed and trained to stop active shooters, we would achieve effective deterrence and the problem would cease to exist.
your response to President Trump?
Yeah, well, I don't know where the evidence for that claim comes from. We don't have any evidence that arming teachers in schools prevents mass shootings, will be a deterrent in any way, particularly for mass shooters who are often motivated, who see what they're doing as a sort of end game kind of action, that they intend their lives to end in those particular instances. And so arming teachers is in no way going to be a deterrent. But I think more broadly, these comments speak to the extent to which guns are simply the material reality in which we live, particularly when it comes to things like handguns. This is a conversation we don't often have so much because we're so often focused on these fearsome assault weapons that have now become the target of even President Biden. But instead, thinking of this problem more in terms of the sort of mundane and commonplace relationship we have with firearms, such that it makes perfectly sense to many people in this country, in certain parts of this country, to suggest that teachers go to school armed, because those teachers already live in communities flooded with guns, and they don't think it would violate any sort of moral or ethical norms for those teachers to go to school armed.
I mean, Drew McKevitt, I mean, look, can you have a more gun-friendly state than Texas? And look what happened in Uvalde, as child after child was gunned down, as SWAT teams, troopers, police, all of them, more than 100 of them, waited for an hour. Talk about fully armed. We're talking about military-level arming. And they wouldn't move forward. And yet you expect to have teachers?
Right. Teachers with essentially no or little training, the equivalent of perhaps the kind of training you might get in a concealed carry class or self-defense class or something like that. Not something like the kind of training you might expect police officers to go through. Many police officers, too, who've also had sort of military training. So the idea that we would arm teachers is simply absurd. When I think about my campus, I don't want anyone on my campus armed, including any of the teachers. And I don't want myself armed. I think beyond the very obvious mechanics of potential violence that creates, there's also that notion of intimidation. And the power relationships that already exist between students and faculty and administrators, and introducing guns into that equation is just insane to my thinking.
And of course, what it does for those that are promoting it, it's just buying more guns. Can you talk about the honoring of Wayne LaPierre? This is the NRA, well known for its corruption, near bankruptcy. How does it possibly maintain the power over state and federal public officials that do not represent even the NRA membership? Is for levels of gun control. I mean, for example, in Colorado now, the legislature just failed to pass an assault weapons ban despite having a Democratic-controlled House, Senate, and governor. Several House Democrats sided with Republicans to kill the bill in committee at 1 a.m. two nights ago.
Yeah, so I think the NRA's power comes from three places. One is the one to which we usually point, which is money. The NRA can dump hundreds of millions of dollars into elections and obviously has been doing that for a long time now, though I think we tend to overestimate that a bit. The other two ways in which the NRA can wield this kind of power are a little more subtle. One is the way in which they're able to rally their base very quickly. They've been able to do this since the 1960s. They were one of the pioneers of direct mail campaigning and so forth, that was able to rally a upwards of a million people already by 1968 to write their congresspeople, to lobby their local and state politicians, to vote against potential federal and state legislation. And the third way, which is the one we don't talk about and we don't really want to talk about, is that the NRA really wields a lot of intimidation and power in that sense. There are, I am confident, politicians who will not cross the NRA, not because of the money issue and not because of the vote issue, but because they're afraid of violence, But because they're afraid of the kind of violence, that social violence and political violence that the NRA could encourage if it wanted to.
You talk about the connection between guns and gun capitalism. What does capitalism have to do with it, Drew? That's central to your forthcoming book.
Yeah. So, my argument is that I think we focus a little too much on questions of rights and abstract concepts like the interpretation of the Second Amendment, and not quite enough on just how much gun capitalism expanded in the post-war era, especially. This goes back to the end of the Second World War. And in the 1950s and the 1960s, we see this incredible expansion of gun consumerism in the United States. In 1950, there was about 45 million.
We're having a little trouble with with the internet. A tree fell on Drew McKevitt's house, so there are some problems there. But I wanted to go to Tennessee. As Tennessee is reeling, legislators push this week to pass laws that shield gun manufacturers instead of children. There is this 2005 law, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, that protected gun manufacturers. We're going to go to break and then come back to Drew McKevitt. His forthcoming book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Stay with us.
The blessed grace of waking up, of breathing in the sheets. And hello to you at the window, hello to you. Down the hill I'd like to take you to where I shot a little deer. My little deer, I'd like to take you down there. Rinsing out the iron cup, to have a glass of wine, to have an iron cup of wine, dear, to drink it down there. A drunken pair, goodbye despair. One night is till one morning, and once at night you held me by and held me until it was morning.
All is Grace by Palace Brothers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Drew McKevitt, author of the forthcoming book Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture and Control in Cold War America. He's associate professor of history at Louisiana Tech University. We're talking to him in Shreveport. We only have a few more minutes, Drew, but if you got cut off right in the middle of you making that connection between this massive proliferation of guns in America. I mean, we don't see anything like this in any industrialized country in the world. The connection between that and capitalism.
Yeah, that's right. And bringing the world in is a really important component there, too, because it's partly the world that helps arm Americans after World War II. We often think of how the United States is responsible for the proliferation of weapons and violence after the Second World War, which is, of course, all true throughout the Cold War. But more so, arms come into the United States after the Second World War. And the American population is armed with the weapons that had been used in the Second World War and left over on battlefields in Europe and Asia. There's a whole cohort of wily entrepreneurs, gun entrepreneurs, who maximize the profits they can get by grabbing these guns from Europe, sometimes for as cheap as less than a dollar each, bringing them over to the United States, and then selling them to an eager population, now increasingly after the Second World War, with more leisure time, with more money, more income available for those kinds of activities. And of course, the most famous of these war surplus imports, there are millions of them, that come into the United States in the 1950s and the 1960s. The most famous of these is the Carcano rifle used by Lee Harvey Oswald to kill John F. Kennedy in 1963. but it's just one of millions that come into the country and truly remake the consumer market for guns in the United States. And they do that in two ways. They make it one centered around war and firearms that have been involved in war and firearms that can be used for war. And that's where we get that's where we see the trajectory leading to something like the popularity of the AR-15. And then the other aspect is that it simply emphasizes cheapness. American consumerism drives down the price of these guns, and a $10 gun becomes just as accessible.